Today is April 16th. It's our class on Mishnah, Baba Kama, Chapter 6, Mishnah 1. It's our second class on this Mishnah. Let's just read through the Mishnah and review a tiny bit of what we saw last time, and then we're going forward. The Mishnah.
Yes.
The Mishnah, which one do you want to take?
I'm in the wrong Baba.
You're in the wrong Baba.
I'm in the Batra.
Oh, no.
Baba Batra.
Oh, no.
Why it looks so unfamiliar?
Perek Shishi.
Yeah.
The sixth Perek. Yeah, first Mishnah. Ready?
Yes. Okay.
We want everyone to be ready. Mary.
Oh, no.
Beth is still looking. No. Let's go.
Chapter 5, yes. Chapter 6.
Page 53, Mary Beth.
Okay, thank you. You're holding up the whole class.
The whole class?
Okay, I got it. Here we are.
Okay. The first Mishnah. Hakonis tzon nadir, b'na'al b'faneya koroi. He who's bringing in his flock to the pen and locked in front of it properly, biyatsa vizika, and they got out and caused damage, patur, the owner is exempt from paying because it was locked properly. Lo na'al b'faneya koroi biyatsa vizika, he didn't lock properly in front of them, and they went forth and they caused damage, chayav, he is obligated to pay for the damage those animals caused. And we said that we're talking here about Shane and Regil. We're not talking about Karen. We're not talking about goring. We're talking about trampling. And we're talking about eating. And we said we're talking about the public domain. I take it back. We said we're talking about the private domain. If they get out and go into someone else's property. If it's in the public domain, then patur, right? Shane and Regil don't have to pay. It's in the private domain. The animals trespassed on someone else's property. Nifratza v'layla. The fence got broken down at night. O shepartsu halistim, or listim broke it down, highway robbers. V'yatsa v'zika, they went forth and they caused damage. I'm talking about the flock. Patur. We'll go back in a minute and remember what you said about that. Hotsiu halistim, halistim hayavim. If the listim took out the animals, then the listim are hayavim. Let us go to the sheet that we have in front of us, the sheet of sources, and let's see a source that we didn't see last time. But we will read it now, and it'll help us in our Tokmet number 2. Source number 2, Babylon and Talmud, Tractate Baba Kama, page 56a to b. And it's just about one line. It says the following. Have the place?
Yes.
Okay. Hotziu alistim listim hayavim. That's a quote from the Mishnah. The listim took the animals out. The listim are hayavim to pay the damage that the animals caused.
Where do you have that?
Number two on the sheet. No, don't go to the second sheet. Number two.
Not at the bottom of the page.
This.
Rabba Kama.
Hotziu alistim.
Yeah. So says on that the Gemara pshita, kevan dafkuha, kai malah birshutaihu lechol mile. Translation, pshita, it's simple, it's clear, it's obvious. Kevan dafkua, since they took them out, the them here is feminine, the flock is feminine. Since they took her out, afkua, the root there is nun pe kuf, nafak, which means to go out in Aramaic. The nun is fallen out. Kevan dafkua, since they took her out, in other words, the least team took the flock out, kaimala biushutayu. La, it, the feminine it, kaima, stands birshutayu, in their possession. In other words, the listim now own the flock. Don't all jump on me at once, I'll explain. Lechol mile, for all matters. And this is what we call kinyanei ganav, the purchases of a thief. Now, what does the word purchase mean? I don't have a better word in English. I have to be careful with that word. Purchase simply means an act that transfers something from one reshut to another reshut, from one ba'alut to another ba'alut, one ownership to another ownership. You can transfer ownership through a contract, through paying money, through picking it up and taking it.
Better words, acquisition.
Acquisition. Thank you, Jeremy. Acquisition.
Didn't we do that with the etog, with the lulav?
Yeah, same thing. So the thieves here, when they took the tzon from the pen and took them out, they acquired the tzon. The tzon now belonged to the thieves. Now you might say, wait a second, that's chote nischar. That's the sinner getting an advantage. But they become his just because he took them out of the pen. We're not talking about getting an advantage here. We're just talking about a halach definition. Once they did an act to take the tzon out of the pen, the tzon become theirs. That doesn't mean they don't have to bring them back.
Right.
They have an obligation now to bring it back to the reshut, to the ba'alut, to the ownership of the owner. But for now, the tzon are theirs. What does it mean that they're theirs? That they're responsible for everything the tzon do.
Mm-hmm.
They have to pay. It also means, for example, that in order to fulfill their obligation vis-a-vis the owner, they have to either pay money or do a transfer of ownership. It wouldn't be enough to leave the tzon in the street, because the tzon now belongs to the thieves. They have to... Okay?
I could see the tzon in the street in Dallas.
I know. Well, so now they're supposed to then accept this... Well, I mean, why wouldn't they? I guess if they took them, they want them.
They might or they might not, but it doesn't matter. The halacha is they are now responsible for the tzon, just like an owner is responsible.
Until they transfer it to somebody else. So they can't just leave them standing around. They have to give them to someone or sell them to someone or kill them. Or...
So now you're talking about the possibility of it. Of a thief to sell something. That's a whole other story. But let's just keep it simple. The thieves own the tzon.
If they own it, they should be able to sell it.
Yeah, perhaps, yes. I just don't know. I'm not...
It's not kinyan totally, because it's not kinyan kasher. But it's kinyan.
No, it's a kinyan. It's a total kinyan.
What if it's a kinyan? In other words, they have to actually take them beyond the fenced in area, or just pulling them a few steps is the kinyan?
No. Like if I go into your house and I pick up your piano and move it from one room to another,
right,
that's not a kinyan. If I take it outside the house,
that makes sense.
The lashon of the afkuha. They took it out. Yeah. So anyway, that's the story. Now, just to make it clear, in the Gemara is asking a kushya. The Gemara says it's so clear that if the listim cause the animals to come out of the pen, that the animals become under the ownership of the listim,
uh-huh,
and therefore, of course, the listim have to pay for damage the animals do. That's so clear and simple. Why did the Mishnah say it?
Pshita.
It's a question. But we're going to go into what the Gemara is doing. It's just clear from the Gemara that that's what the Mishnah means. That they got ba'alut on the animals, and now the listim are obligated for everything that happens. That's clear. Okay. Now let's look at the Tosfot in number 3.
Uh-huh.
O shepirtsua listim. Right. That's where the Mishnah says that the listim broke down the fence, the animals went out and caused damage. Patur. The list. Who's patur? So it says Tosfot. Vitzterich lashminan. Vitzterich laashmoinan. Defilu halistim petuim shalom hotziua. It has to make us hear that even the listim are exempt when they didn't take them out. Right? The end of the Mishnah says the listim took the animals out, then there the listim are hayavim. But if the listim didn't take the animals out, but just broke the fence down, the animals got out themselves, it's not just that the owners are exempt, but even the listim are exempt. Okay?
Not okay. It makes no sense. If somebody broke into my evil bulldog and didn't take him, a robber, but the bulldog went out and beat the neighbor's child, I'm responsible? After all, the robbers broke into my house.
No, you're not responsible. I just said now, that the owners are not responsible, neither are the listim.
But they still have him.
No.
Nobody, no person is responsible then? What about this thing?
No one's responsible.
The poor kid that was beaten.
A person is always responsible? I mean,
a person is responsible. That's Adam. You're responsible for your own actions. But you didn't bite the child. The dog bit the child. Adam wa'ad lo'olam, that's Adam hamazik. That's a man who causes damage directly. But all these other things, shame, regal, shame. Right? So in the case in which the lease, if the owners locked the fence properly, right, and the lease team came and broke it down, and the dog got out and caused damage, no one has to pay.
Huh. So it's kind of like two. They're still owned by the owner.
Still owned by the owner, but the owner did his shmirah, right?
He locked them properly.
Now the Rambam's going to come and limit this halacha because he doesn't like what's happening here.
But who is responsible for repairing the pritza?
Oh, that's a good question. But it's simple. The lease team broke it down, they have to pay. That's simple.
So they're not totally pturim.
They're pturim
for the shen and regel.
Because they didn't bite the child.
Yeah.
But they broke down the fence. But they certainly have to pay for the fence. Unfortunately, I'm not knowledgeable enough to know if that's the proper word. But I understand why you think it is. Just, I don't want to say things I don't know. Okay. So now, we can go back and plug in everything we just learned to the second half of the Mishnah. Nifratzu habalayla, right, that we said, is when the fence was broken down, but it doesn't say who did it. Osha partzu a listim, or the listim broke it down, v'yatzav yizika patur. Otsiu a listim, listim chayvim. So we said, it means that the listim took the animals out, they're obligated, and the balabait, the owner, is patur. If the listim just broke down the fence, then they're exempt from the damage that the animals caused, and the owners are also exempt, because the fence, I assume, was locked. And if it got broken down on its own, right, it says, nifratza b'layla, then the owners are patur. But then remember, we said, wait a second, if you make that statement that nifratza b'layla means the owner is patur, how does that jive with the first part of the Mishnah that said if the owners locked it properly, patur, the owners didn't lock it properly, chayav. But then you said if it got broken belayla, the owners are patur. But wait a second, you already covered all the cases. Either they locked it or didn't lock it. But what has Lila come in? Do you remember that question we asked?
Mm-hmm.
And of course then Jeremy gave an answer, which was a good answer. And let's just read again the Tosfot that we worked with last time.
Jeremy say?
Well, let's read the Tosfot. Let's read the Tosfot.
I said like the Tosfot.
Yeah. So Tosfot says, it's number 4 on the sheet, Nifratza b'layla, afal pi detana quote na'al b'fnei kara'ui patur, it's the rich limitne nifratza b'layla patur. That's a statement of the difficulty in the language already telling you the answer to the question. What does Tosfot say? I'm going to translate it. Even though we learned, quote, that if he locked properly his patur, it still needs to teach us nifratza layla patur, because, in other words, you would think there's a kushya here, because if he locked it properly, patur, so why does it have to tell us that if it happened at night, patur, we already know he's patur, because he locked it properly. Why does it say at night it's patur? Of course he's patur. The answer is, kidedayik beperakama, as we learned in the first chapter, daik, learned language of to be midayek, to be miduyak. We really exacted it out in the first chapter. Habayom chayav, behold, in the daytime he's obligated. Dekala itle, that a voice it has, and that it's well known that the animals got out. Lemitle, the matter. And minastam, in other words, and probably he knows that the animals got out. So what did Tosfot just say? I'll translate, I'll explain. That the reason you have to say that nifratza b'layla is patur, even though you already know that if you lock the fence, it's patur. The reason I have to say that is because nifratza b'layla implies that in the daytime, if the fence got broken down, he would be chayav. And it's coming to tell you that even if you lock the fence, which is usually patur, if it got broken down in the daytime, when a man knows what's happening, and he can notice the animals are all walking around, he's chayav. Even though he locked the fence, he's chayav, because now he's an opportunity to go and round them up, and he didn't do it. Therefore, he's chayav. So that's the way Tosfot explains the relationship between the first clause and the second clause. That the second clause that says Nifritza b'layla patur is really coming to say Nifritza b'yom hayav. If it happened in the daytime, hayav, even though he locked it, he's obligated to go and get the sheep because it's in the daytime, he can do it, and if he didn't, he's hayav. That's what it's saying, and that makes sense, except for the fact that it's the exact opposite of what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah didn't say Nifratza b'yom, it said Nifratza b'layla. So you ask Tosfot, so why didn't it say what it means?
Right.
And to answer that, last week we said we could take a whole different direction in this, which was suggested by Professor Hanoch Albeck, and he said no. The assumption that Tosfot made is wrong. It's a suggestion. Tosfot said, Nifritza b'layla patur, it's talking about the Baal HaBayit. And therefore we had the conflict with the first clause. Tosfot said, no, perhaps it's talking about a thief. And the way to read it is, Nifritza b'layla, it got broken down at night by thieves, and thieves come out at night. Oh, Pratsua Listim, or Listim broke it down, that's the daytime, because Listim, highway robber, is there in the daytime. Uh-huh. And animals got out and caused damage. Patur means the thieves at night and the Listim in the daytime are Patur, but it's not talking about the Baal HaBayit. The law of Baal HaBayit is not being discussed here, and therefore there's no conflict, there's no tension with the first part of the Mishnah. The first part of the Mishnah stands that as far as the Baal HaBayit locked it good, he's exempt. Didn't lock it good, he's not exempt. That was what Professor Albeck said, and that was the end of last week's class. You ready for this week's class?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So here we go. We're going to read source 1, B1.
Can you, before we embark further, because I'm a little lost,
mm-hmm.
What does Albeck say, really? That the listim at daytime and the ganavim at night when?
The ganavim and the listim who broke down the fence but didn't take the animals out.
Paturim.
Now that
they have such privileges.
Oh no, Louis, but that halakha is not what Professor Albeck innovates. We knew that halakha already. That if they didn't actually do the action, take them out, they're patur. We knew that already. He just explains that that's what's being said in the first part of the second clause, Nifratza b'layla. Nifratza b'layla is not telling us that it happened on its own, such that the Baal HaBayit is patur. No, it's talking about an activity of the ganavim.
Not ruach she'ena metzuyah.
Right. Talking about an activity of the ganavim. Okay. So we're going to read the Gemara in source number 1. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Baba Kama, page 55b. Here we go. Ready?
Yes.
Okay. The Gemara says as follows. Tanu Rabbanan, we learned in the Mishnah. Ezehu Karaui, Vezahu Shilokarui. Which is proper and which is not proper? What does it mean that they locked it properly or not properly? The answer is simple, we talked about it already. Delet Shihola Lamod Baruach Mitsuya Zokarui. A door that can stand in a normal wind, that is Rui, that's proper. Sheina Yehola Lamod Baruach Mitsuya. Zel shekalokui, that which cannot stand in a normal wind, that is the definition of shelokui, of not properly, right? That we talked about already. I'm just reading that to get to the next part of the Gemara. And now the interesting part of the Gemara. Amar Rabbi Mani Bar Patish, said Rabbi Mani Bar Patish, Man Tana Muad Desagile B'Shmira Pchuta. Translation, who learned it, that's who taught it, who holds it, that a muad, sagile, it's enough for it, sagi means it's enough for it, bishmira pchuta, with minimal shmira, who holds that position? Why is this rabbi asking that? Because he looks at our Mishnah, which all you have to do to be patur is to lock the gate. Doesn't say you have to build a big wall. Doesn't say that you have to slaughter all the animals. All you have to do is lock the gate. And that's called shmirat chuta, minimal shmirat, language of pachot, a little bit. And he's asking, who holds this position? Right? The Mishnah doesn't mention names of rabbis. Who is it that holds this position? That shmirat chuta is enough. In other words, we want to look at different Mishnayot in our literature and see if there's any rabbi that we can see from a different source that holds this position, and we'll know that rabbi is the author of this Mishnah. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. So who is it? And the answer is Rabbi Yehuda. It's Rabbi Yehuda. Because I'll show you from a different source that Rabbi Yehuda is the only rabbi that holds that Shmirat Chuta is enough to get you off the hook of damages. Let's read Ditanan, as we learned in the Mishnah. It's a Mishnah we looked at last time. The Mishnah says, Ksharo ba'alav b'mosera. Tied it, its owners, with a leech. V'na'al lifanei akirui. And locked in front of it as proper. V'yatsa v'zika, and it went forth, and it did damage. Ahad tam v'had muad. Whether tam or muad, chayav. Divrei Rabbi Meir. That's Rabbi Meir. And that can't be our Mishnah, because there it says that... There it says chayav, whereas our Mishnah says patur. Right, this is a case of tying it up and locking properly. And it says you're chayav, so that can't be in accord with our Mishnah. But that's Rabbi Meir. Now it says Rabbi Yehuda Meir, tam chayav muad patur. In the same case, you put on a leash or you locked it properly. So this Rabbi Yehuda says tam chayav muad patur.
That looks mixed up.
I know, but let's just look at it. Again, we talked about this last week, this Mishnah in a different context. I know it looks mixed up. But anyway, Rabbi Yehuda says the Muad Patur. Now, an animal that's Muad is Patur. And of course, in our Mishnah, we're talking about Muad. Because if you're talking about... Because it doesn't say we're talking about Tam. You always know, normal case is Muad. So you see that Rabbi Yehuda says, even though you tied it up properly or you locked properly... I'm sorry, because you tied up properly or locked properly, you're Patur when you're Muad. This is exactly what our Mishnah says. And we won't bring the proof that's brought there in
is
the
there
Mishnah.
Somebody at the door? Something is knocking.
If anyone's at the door, you can come in. But I think not.
I think it's a plumbing.
You just have an extra good ear.
But may I ask something? Tam and Muad is about Keren, not about Sheva.
Oh, you're right. The Gemara is conveniently ignoring the differences between Keren, Sheva, and Regelnat now. It's just saying, I don't know about that stuff, that's not important. In our Mishnah, we're talking about Muad, it has to pay Nezek Shalem, it's talking about Muad. Let's look at other places of Muad, and you see another place of Muad. Rabbi Meir says, Chayav with Shmirat Chuta, but Rabbi Yehuda says, Patur. So our Mishnah must be Rabbi
Yehuda.
And then it brings a proof, Shneamar, Velo Yishmerenu Ba'alav, Shemor Huzeh. Then it brings Rabbi Eliezer, which we don't have to read, Ein Lo Shmirat Sakin. Right? That's all from that Mishnah. That's the end of the Mishnah, the quoted the Mishnah, and we've ended a thought. So again, where we are now, as Anna pointed out, we're ignoring the differences between Shein Kelin and Regel. We're just saying that our Mishnah says, Shmirah Pchuta, you're Patur, and it's talking about Muad, it's Nezek Shalem, a normal case. Where else did we see such a thing? We saw Rabbi Yehuda, who says, with a sure Muad, you have to pay your Patur when you did Shmirah Pchuta. So our Mishnah is Rabbi Yehuda, and it's not Rabbi Meir, who had said that Shmirat Pchuta doesn't help. And now the Gemara is going to object to this line of reasoning, just as Ilana wanted to object. Here we go. Okay, we're going on. Afilu Tema Rabbi Meir, which means even you can say Rabbi Meir. And I want to explain very exactingly what that means. It doesn't mean that our Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. It means our Mishnah could also be Rabbi Meir. Right? It's not limiting it to Rabbi Meir. It's saying what you just said could be that our Mishnah is Rabbi Yehuda, but I also have a way of saying that our Mishnah could also be
Rabbi Meir.
Rabbi Meir. Right? So it's not coming to limit, it's coming to expand. Afilu Tema Rabbi Meir, shiny shein v'regel.
What is shiny?
Shiny means it's different.
Ashoneh.
Like shoneh. And probably, I'm pronouncing it in Yeshivish, but probably in real Aramaic it's pronounced differently. And the truth is that even though I stopped in the middle of a sentence, we could understand what it's saying. It's saying what Ilana said. That you could say that it's not that our Mishnah is Rabbi Yehuda, who says that Muad is exempt from paying when the Shmirah Pruta. No, it's a whole different story. Our Mishnah is different than that previous Mishnah, because ours is shiny Shein Veregel. It's different Shein Veregel. Our Mishnah is Shein Veregel, whereas the previous Mishnah was
Karen.
So we could say that our Mishnah even holds like Rabbi Meir, but it distinguishes between Karen on the one hand, in which Shmirah Pruta is not enough, because for sure, Karen, you have to watch more. Shmirah Pruta is not enough. But our Mishnah is talking about Shein Veregel, and Rabbi Meir would say you need less Shmirah for Shein Veregel. And therefore, Shmirah Pruta is Patur. So in other words, we're saying that our Mishnah doesn't have to be limited to Rabbi Yehuda. It could also be Rabbi Meir. And then everyone is happy. Our Mishnah is true according to everyone.
Even Rabbi Eliezer.
Perhaps even Rabbi Eliezer. But we're not talking about that. But that could also be. So now, we'll read it again and we'll finish the thought. Afilu teima Rabbi Meir, shiny shein veregel, da Torah miata b'shmiratan. Shein and regel are different because the Torah limited their shmirah. And the Torah limited your obligation to watch them because they don't do too much damage. They're not like a shore that's so dangerous. And then it brings a proof that the Torah limits the amount of watching that you have to devote to Shein Veregel in order to be Patur. Dama Rabbi Elazar Vamri Lava Matnita Tana, that Rabbi Elazar said, and there are those who say that it's actually taught in a Braita, quote, Arba'a Dvarim HaTorah Miata B'Shmiratan. Four things the Torah limited their Shmirah. Four things the Torah said, you know what, you don't have to watch them too seriously in order to be exempt if they cause damage. And what are they? Veiluhen, and they are Bor, Ve'esh, Shein Veregel. Now Bor, we know already what it's going to say. Where did we talk about last time?
You're covering it properly.
Right. All you have to do to get out of being responsible for damage caused by your hole is to cover it. You don't have to fill it in.
Huh.
So you see that Shmirah Pchuta is enough in a Bor. And it goes on to say that Bor, Dichtiv, a Bor, as we learned, as it's written in the Torah, and it gives you the citation from Shmot Chaf Aleph, Exodus 21. Quote, Ki yiftach ishbor, o ki yichre ishbor, v'lo yichasenu. If a man will open up, in other words, will dig a pit. I'm sorry. If a man will open up a pit, or if a man will dig a pit, and will not cover it, and then it goes on to say that he is obligated to pay if someone falls in. But you hear from that if he covered it, he doesn't have to pay, even though he didn't fill it in. So you see from there that you only need Shmirah Pruta. That's what the source goes on to say. Hakisao, behold, you learn from here that if he covered it, patur. And then it brings the same proof for Esh, that for fire, you don't have to have Shmirah Mula, but only Shmirah Pruta. You don't have to do anything but minimal Shmirah for your fire. And if it got out of hand, you're patur, as long as you gave minimal Shmirah. But you don't have to build a 10-foot wall around your fireplace. It's enough to do a little wall. We don't have to read the proof. And then the next line, the second word of the line, is Shein. As I proved to you that for Shein, you only need Shmirah Pruta. And it quotes the verse, Dichtiv Shmot Chavbet, right, Exodus 22. The verse is, Uvi'er Bissadeh Acher. And the way the sources traditionally translate those three words is, Bi'er means he caused to graze. He causes animals to graze Bissadeh Acher, in a different field. And from that you learn, you're only obligated to pay if you brought your animals to a different field. But if you didn't bring them there, they just got there on their own, you're not obligated. From there we learn, all you need is minimal shmirah. Locking the gate would be enough. and any animals got to someone else's field on their own, you don't have to pay. You don't have to pay when you did something active, or to put it in different language, you had specific negligence. But if you acted normally, with shame you are patur, and then it brings the same proof for regular. Shame and regular only obligatory when you really have something positive that you did. Either you brought them to another field or you are positively negligent, but if you, as long as you did some minimal shmirah, you are patur with shein v'regel. Okay, so that's where we're holding now.
So the attempt to find an author is still failing.
Yes, you're right, but the Gemara has a different way of looking at it than you. The Gemara says the fact that we didn't limit our Mishnah to one author is a plus, it's not a minus.
We learned something from it.
Now that we learned that we can attribute our Mishnah
to all of them,
that's a plus. That's the fact that we haven't pinned down our Mishnah to one author, that's a plus, it's not a minus, it's a plus.
Oh, because then it's everybody's opinion.
Yeah, then it's going to be universally accepted.
It's not a minority.
Right. Right. We could say that our Mishnah is universally accepted both by Rabbi Meir and not both by Rabbi Yehuda. That's what we're holding now. And then we come to Amar Rabbah. See the place? It's the last three lines. It's the next paragraph.
Yeah.
Amar Rabbah. Matnitin nami daika. Our Mishnah is also exacting. What that means is, in context, that Rabbi is saying, it's not that our Mishnah is like Rabbi Yehuda and also Rabbi Meir. No, I'm going to tell you that our Mishnah is specifically Rabbi Yehuda. He wants to pin it down. The Mishnah Daika, the Mishnah is exactly according to one of them. Dekatani Tzon. That it learns, quote, Tzon. It says the word Tzon. It says the word flock. Michdi b'shor kaskin and va'ati. Since in ox we were dealing and continuing, askin and va'ati, we were dealing and continuing. The whole earlier chapters were always talking about shor. Suddenly it's talking about son. That must be meaningful. So I'm going to read what it says again. Matniti nami daika. The Mishnah also is specific. Don't tell me it's both opinions. It's specific. The Mishnah is specifically going to be Rabbi... Who did we say? I forgot now what we're saying. But let's read on. I'll say it. The Mishnah is specific. Dekatani tzon, as we learned tzon. Michdi b'shor, since in shor kaskin and vati, we were dealing and going. Nitni shor. Let it say sure. And we're always talking about sure. This Mishnah should also have said sure. My shna dekatanit zon. Why is it different that it learned zon? It must be that it specifically meant zon and not sure.
Right.
It must be that. In other words, don't tell me that you can understand our Mishnah without reference to the difference between shor and son. No, the Mishnah must specifically be about son and not about shor. The previous Mishnah were about shor. This one is about son.
Okay.
And it's telling, and it's saying, Lav mishum de Torah miata bishmiratan? Isn't it because the Torah limited their shmirah? It's, why did our Mishnah talk about tzon? Isn't it because the Mishnah wants to tell you that this particular case of tzon, their shmirah is limited, but it's not true for sure? In other words, the point is that this Mishnah wants to say that for tzon you need less shmirah, you need less shmirah than you need for shor. Which means what? It means that our Mishnah would say that this particular law of locking it and then you're exempt if it happens, that's specifically in tzon, but shor would be different.
If it was one animal, it would be a different...
No, if it... This is flocks, but if it was oxen, it would be different. Oxen are different than flocks. Okay. Flocks are shein v'regel. You need less shmirah. But if it was going to be, sure, you'd need more shmirah. So in other words, that is that we're saying here, this is Rabbi Meir. This Mishnah is Rabbi Meir. specifically Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir was the one that said earlier that you're hayav if you lack properly, talking about the shor. This one says that sewn is different. Shein and regular is different. Let me stop for a minute and make sure that everyone understands where we are. Okay? So what we're saying now is this Mishnah specifically told us tzon.
Yes.
Why did it specifically say tzon? It must be because it's a law that's specific to tzon. It's not found in shor.
Is this law good for chicken?
Good for anything that's like tzon, which means shein v'regel. So the answer is yes. But not good for oxen that are aggressive. Not good for Karen. So in other words, we're postulating now that the Mishnah says it's sown, that is to say, shein v'regel, that you're exempt if you lack, because they require minimal shmirah, but Karen requires more shmirah. So we're going to postulate, according to this Mishnah, if it had been Karen, and you had locked it properly and got out, you'd have to pay, because Karen requires more shmirah.
So it's not the number of animals.
No, not the number.
It's the kind of...
Okay. It's the type of damage.
Okay.
That's what Rabbah is saying. He's saying, read our Mishnah carefully. Why did specifically say tzon when earlier Mishnah said shor? The answer is because our Mishnah is giving us a law of leniency that specifically relates to tzon. And don't tell me the law would be the same for Karen. It's not. The law for Karen would be different. The law would be, if you did this minimal shmirah, the law would be chayav. And who would hold chayav? Going back to the Mishnah we brought earlier, the answer would be Rabbi Meir would say you're chayav.
And what are you? Why? Where do you?
Because he said concerning the shor, if you locked it up and it got out and did damage, you're chayav. But saying that's.
But why does he say muat patur?
That's Rabbi Yehuda. I said I'm talking about Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir says that oxen
chayav
because that's Karen. Whereas our Mishnah says that tzon, that's to say shein v'regel, has to do less shmirah, so you're patur if you locked it properly.
Okay.
So we're in trouble with, like, say, with billy goats.
At this point is that Rabba is saying that our Mishnah is to be understood according to one of the opinions and not to both of them. Only Rabbi Meir and not Rabbi Yehuda.
Makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. Because the Mishnah does say tzon. And all the previous Mishnah did talk about tzon. Why did we suddenly change? Because the law is different. That tzon have a different law than Karen does. Karen needs more shmirah. And you're hayav even if you locked it up. But tzon needs less shmirah, so you're not hayav if you locked it up. Everything makes perfect sense now.
Now, this exercise to identify the author, they don't mean that this is the author for sure, but that is according to the spirit of
right,
the author,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Right.
So now, it really makes sense. That's the pshat. But tzon should be understood as specifically tzon. And tzon is shein v'regel. Shein v'regel requires less shmirah than Karen. What's interesting is, and this is a typical move in the Gemara doesn't like this. Because the Gemara always wants to try to not pin things down.
Really?
Not limit things. Not limit it to one approach, one author, one understanding, but show that you can also understand it according to other ways. So the answer says, love. Look where we are now. It's about 15 words from the end, right over here. Love. We tried to pin it down, and we said, no, that's not necessarily so. We can expand it again and say the Mishnah is really according to both Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Now, the way that the Mishnah does, the Gemara does this, is really hard to understand. But we'll see if we can understand it. But the point is, this is what I want to emphasize, that the Gemara's purpose is always to open things up more than it is to close things down. More than to understand it in a specific ideological way, is to say we can understand it in multiple ways. The Gemara wants to leave it as open as possible. It's not just Rabbi Meir, it also could be Rabbi Yehuda. And even though it might be unlikely that it's Rabbi Yehuda, Gemara just wants it to be on the table that it also could be up to, even though it's unlikely. How? So it says love. No, we don't want to limit it just to Rabbi Meir. Love, not so. Mishum dekan keren lo kativa ba, shein beregel hu dekativa, bekama shmelan de shein beregel de muadin hu shmamina. Which is not easy to understand. I'm going to give it one interpretation. It could be saying the following. No, we're not limiting it to Rabbi Meir. We're not limiting it to Shein Beregel. Rather, it's saying, why does it say what it say? Why does it say Tzon? Mishum dekan keren lo kativa ba, Shein Beregel hu dekativa. Because here, keren is not written.
Yeah.
Shein Beregel is what's written. V'kamash malan, and it comes to teach us of Shein Beregel de Muadin hu. Now it's talking Shein Beregel not because of Shein Beregel, but to talk about Muad.
Oh.
It doesn't come to limit and say this halakha is a law of Shein Beregel, whereas Karen is different. It comes to talk about Shein Beregel, not for Shein Beregel, but for Muad, to tell you that Muadim has a different law than Tam. Mm-hmm. But not to tell you that Shein Beregel is a different law than Karen. But the Gemara wants to open up and say, perhaps it's just telling you that all Muadim require Shmirah Mula. But it's not necessarily telling you, I'm sorry, that all Muadim require Pchuta, Shmirah Pchuta. Telling you that same to the Muad that pay full damage don't require much Shmirah. You know what? That even might include Karen. Or it might not. But it's not saying this matter of Shmirah Pchuta is limited to Shein Beregel, not to Karen. It might be limited to Muad and not to Tam. If it's a talking about Muad, then that includes Karen. Which means that this could be not just Rabbi Meir, but also Rabbi Yehuda. Because Rabbi Yehuda said the difference is between Tam and Muad. Tam is Chayav if you had Shmirah Pchuta, but Muad is patur if you had Shmirah Pchuta.
I still don't understand that.
Good question. Okay, fine. That's a separate question. Okay. We said last time it's patur just from the extra payment.
Okay.
Ah, okay.
That's a good point. So I just want to emphasize, again, the Gemara tries not to limit things to one opinion, to one approach, to one understanding, but to show that things are possibly understood according to multiple understandings. Why do I want to emphasize that? Because that's my ideology. I'm grinding my axe, right? but I'm serious. The Gemara does this again and again and again and again and again. I'll just tell you a story that in yeshiva, I always had difficulty with this point because my teacher, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, the son-in-law of Rav Soloveitchik, his method in teaching shiurim was to show you could understand everything in 15 different ways. And it was the most confusing thing in the world. You thought you understood. You don't know. You can understand it like this, and like this, and like this, and like this, like this. And he'd give the most unlikely ways. And I'd say to myself, what are we talking about this for? That's not the truth. That's not what it says. Let's fight over it and figure out the true way to understand it. Like Rav Lichtenstein used to say that he learned from his father-in-law, learned from his father, that you don't die of a kusha. You don't die from something that's difficult. But like we said, he's wrong. You do die from a kusha. You have to figure it out and you get the truth. But Rav Lichtenstein always said, we're not searching for the truth. We're searching for possibilities. And I really never understood it until I saw that it fits into a larger way of understanding the world, which is what the Talmud is all about. The Talmud is not about searching for the truth. It's about searching for possible truths. Does it again and again and again. And this is actually a very good example of that.
It's opening it.
Yeah. In a certain sense, it's very much against my personality. I want the truth!
Tell me the answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was the way Jim always says, well, so what is the halakha?
Yes.
What was the law? How'd they settle it?
And that's the way most people want it. But the Talmud is not like that. It's not searching for the truth. It's searching for possible truths. Okay.
So it always comes to open for more and more.
Yeah. Yeah. And Rav Lichtenstein would drive us crazy. It was unbelievable. He would have to show so many different ways of understanding the simplest thing.
And was it really convincing?
No. It wasn't convincing. But this Gemara is also not convincing. And it's really not meant to convince you. The pshat is really like Rabbi said. that it's a difference of Karen and Shane Berger. I think that's the pshat. But the Gemara wants to show you, you could, if you want to force it, understand differently. Okay. That's behind us. And now, I want to spend the last hour and a half.
Now, do you like it? Do you like this opening?
It's certain. I've come to realize the greater truth of it. There's a great humility that we really can't know the truth. We think we do, but we're all subjective. So it took me many, many years to understand and to reconcile myself with this pluralism. Of that, of course, I've come to embrace it. But it took a long, 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 long time. I just remember my frustration. I come up to my wife and start ranting against my Rav, against Rav Lichtenstein, and he can't tell us the truth. If he doesn't know the truth, who does? Like, you'd read the Gemara according to five different Rishonim, and you might figure out, they're all saying the same principle. Then Rav Lichtenstein would have to come and show you another approach. And another approach. Okay. So, we're going to put that aside.
Okay.
And go to another matter. And that other matter is on the second sheet of the handout, number 6.
Yes.
Talmud Bavli Masechet Bava Kama Daf Nun Hei Amud Bet, going on to Nun Vav Amud Aleph.
Tanya.
55b to 56a, and perhaps we'll wait a second to see if Jeremy's going to come back.
And Tanya is from the Mishnah or the Braita?
Tanya's a Braita. So the Gemara here is bringing a Braita.
What are the keywords as long as Jeremy's out?
Tanan
is Mishnah.
Is a Mishnah. Tanya is a Braita. Tanu Rabbanan is usually also a Braita, usually. And Tana is also a Braita. The
only one that Tan is Tanan.
Mishnah is Tanan. So let's look. We're on source 6.
I'm with your name.
Mm-hmm. Tanan Hanan. Right. So number 6 is like this. Tanya. Amar Rabbi Yeshua. Arba'a dvarim. Hose otan patur midine adam v'chaya bidine shamayim. 4 things. He who does them is exempt in the laws of man and culpable in the laws of heaven. Okay. There's a concept in halakhic Jewish jurisprudence, especially in torts, but not only, also even in capital cases of death, when you kill someone, that you could be exempt in the court law, but we say God will get you. No. And that's taken seriously. Ve'eluhen, and these are those. Now, what it means, chayav b'dinei shamayim, in torts, is you should pay. You don't have to pay, but you should pay. God wants you to pay, but the courts can't force you. What are these 4 cases in which the courts can't force you? Eluhen, haporetz gader bifnei beimat chaviro. If you break down the fence in the face of the animal of your fellow, and something happens, it doesn't say what, didn't get to it yet. We'll get to it. And I left out the other 3 cases. Just going to focus on this. If you break down the fence in the face of your friend's animal. Now, what it sounds like it means is, it doesn't say just break down the fence, break down the fence in the face of the animal. It sounds like the animal got out and caused damage. And this is a case in which you're not obligated in the laws of man. We learned that in Mishnah, you're not, right? Mm-hmm. Like the listim. But you are obligated in the laws of heaven. You should pay. Okay, so that comes kind of to calm you from what bothered you earlier. So we're not going to read the other 3 cases in which you're hayav in dinei shamayim. We're going to read what the Gemara says about this case. Amar Rav, says the Master, Haporetz gader bifnei beimat chaviro, the case in which you broke down the fence in the face of the animal of your fellow, heichidami. Heichidami means how so, which means what was the case? What are you talking about exactly? What are the circumstances? Heichidami, how so? I lema bekotel bari, if you say it's in a healthy wall, then bedine adam nami chayav. in the laws of men, you should also be obligated. Ela b'kotel ra'uah. Rather, we're talking about a weak wall. So in other words, if you broke down the fence, an animal got out and caused damage, well, if it's a weak wall, that it might have fallen anyway, then that's what we meant. You're not obligated in court, but you're obligated from heaven. But if it's a real good wall, then you're obligated even in the laws of man.
First of all, who is this Mar?
Just Mr. Someone, one of the rabbis.
Monsieur. Okay, but are you allowed to open the wall of your friend's house?
No, of course not. You can't break down his fence without permission.
Then, so, if you do, and his
animals get out, if it was a good wall and animals got out and damaged, you're in trouble. You have to pay for the damage that the animals do. But if it was a weak wall, which might have fallen down anyway, you don't have to pay.
Because your friend is obligated.
You know, that might be a weak wall, like they're not penned in.
Yeah.
So the guy is, yeah.
But aren't you obligated for the hole in the wall?
That's another question. Let's not talk about the hole in the wall.
So we are talking
about... But that's obvious. You break down your friend's wall, you have to pay for the wall.
Yeah. So we are only talking about the nezek of the behemoth.
Yes. Is anyone bothered by something I said? You should be bothered. Well,
I feel a little bit bothered, and maybe I'm missing something, but maybe this is what you're driving at. What's this Bedine Adam Nami Nihayav that he says Yulima Bekotel Bria Bedine Adam Nami.
Right, if the kotel was a good kotel, it was gonna stand up well.
But he's not. Didn't
very he good. Say exactly. In other words, Jeremy's pointing out.
What is he saying?
Jeremy just said.
Yeah, Jeremy, what are you saying?
I think the rabbi should speak and then
spill out what I'm sorry, I just wanted to make sure we don't go until 10 o'clock. That's why
he might be able to spell it out better than I could anyway.
I'm sure you could say it well. I just granted you because the time is late. Jeremy's pointed out the way that I just explained the Gemara is beautiful, except it contradicts our Mishnah 100%. Because we're explaining the Gemara saying that if it's a good wall and someone comes and breaks it down, animals get out and cause damage, the guy who broke the wall down is obligated. That's a very nice halakha, but the Mishnah said the opposite.
Right.
The Mishnah said the least team that broke down the wall, the animals got out, the least team up a door. Right? So, you're right. Mm-hmm. So that's, read the Rambam now. The Rambam says as follows. This is in the Mishnah Torah. Okay? You with me?
Yes.
Ha-poretz gader b'fnei b'imat chavero b'yatsat b'hizika. You broke down the wall in front of the animals of your fellow, and they went forth and caused damage. Imeya gader chazaku bari chayav. If the wall was strong and healthy, chayav. Right, the guy who broke it down is obligated to pay for the damage that the animals did. Imeya kotel roa. But if the wall was weak anyway, the animals would have gotten out anyway. Patur midine adam, exempt in the laws of man. The chayav midine shamayim. Exactly like the Gemara said, the Rambam is bringing it fine. I'm going to skip the next words in the Rambam because the time is late. So the Rambam just brings the Gemara. Now look at Hasagot HaRa'avad, the strictures of Rav Avram ben David, a younger contemporary of the Rambam who criticizes the Rambam often. And he says what Jeremy said. How can you write this, guy? It's the opposite of what the Mishnah said. Not only that the Mishnah said it, but you, the Rambam, quoted the Mishnah earlier. So how could you now say the opposite? I'll read it. Aporitz gader v'fnei beimat chavero v'yatsat v'zika. He's just quoting the Rambam. Imaya gader chazak bari chayav. That's quoted the Rambam. Amar Avraham. Says
Avraham. Himself?
Is himself. That's the way he begins his comment. Aleph, Aleph. Amar Avraham. And he's Avraham. Ze shamar chayav, lo yadanu mahu. This that he said chayav, we don't know what. How could you say chayav? I don't understand what you're saying. Next line, im ala kotel amar. If on the wall he said it, that the guy who broke the wall has to pay for the wall, right? Lama leila meimar yatsat v'hizika. Why did the Rambam write the words, went out and caused damage? It's obviously the Rambam says when animals cause damage, the animals cause damage. But if the Rambam's telling us that you're obligated for breaking down the wall, you have to pay for the wall, what does it matter to write about the animals? So obviously the Rambam didn't mean that you're obligated to pay for the damage to the wall. He meant you're obligated to pay the damage that the animals do. V'mal ha'nezek amar. But if on the nezek, the damage done by the animals, he said, ain't okay, it's not so, the halakha's wrong. The halakha shouldn't be that the guy who broke down the wall has to pay for the damage the animals did. It's wrong. Ela'im kein, except if he kishua vidrichua lenezek. Except if he spurred on and directed the animals to cause the damage, right? Because that's the case of the listim who took the animals out. Then the guy who broke down the wall has to pay if they took the animals out. Like, push the animals out. But if you just broke down the wall, the law in the Mishnah is patur. So why did the Rambam say chayav?
Maybe he paid attention to the word ifnei.
No, there's a different answer.
So it brings it out.
No, I mean, the answer we know because the Rambam came and wrote a letter to explain what he meant.
Oh, okay.
So let's here do. We
how
have
convenient.
How we here we have Shut HaRambam,
the Shelot
and Shuvot. Shuvot, the response of the Rambam. So you can say in parentheses, L'chokhmei Luniel. This was a letter the Rambam wrote to the wise men of Luniel. Luniel is a city in southern France, what the Jews call Provence. Right? And in the time of the Rambam, the very end of the Rambam's life, there was a very, very strong community there, and the Chochmei Luniel had great respect for the Rambam, and they wrote questions to him often. And this was one of the questions they asked him. And if we had time, we would read the whole question they asked, and the Rambam responds very, very much in depth, but we won't read the whole thing, there's no time, we'll just read the answer itself. Here's the Rambam. So we're just going to read the third paragraph.
Okay.
The Rambam's answer. V'zeh shekikishtam
ekshetem
al devar zeh. And that you question this matter, and again I'm going to go quickly, let's go to the second line of that paragraph, the four words before the three dots. V'dai kusha hizot. Certainly a difficulty this is. Now, you guys are right. You caught me. This is a good one. Okay?
Okay.
So the same kusha that the Ra'avad asked on the Rambam, the Chochmei Luniel also asked, the wise men of Luniel, and they got an answer. And here's the answer. I'm reading right after the three dots. V'zehu peruka. And this is its solution. Here we go. Hefresh gadol. There's a big difference. Yesh, there is, bein listim she pirtsu hadir, between highway robbers that broke down the pen, uvein chaviro she paratz lifnei bemto, and his fellow that broke down in the wall in face of the animals. The question is, who did it?
Yeah.
That's the difference. Shalistim kavanatam ligno vebeima, that the highway robbers, their intention is to steal the animal. Leficha kozman shelo hotziua mirshuta balim, therefore all the sman, all the while, that they didn't take out the animal from the domain of the owners, lo nitchayvu b'negneva, they're not culpable in stealing. Below neset birshutam, and it isn't made into their domain. But at the time that they will actually take the animal out, neset birshutam, that it's made into their domain, v'nitchayev v'nizekeya, and they become obligated in the damage that the animals do. So the intention, I'm just going to say it again in my own language, the intention of the thieves is to steal the animals. If they succeed, therefore, in stealing them, the animals become theirs.
Kinyan.
And they're obligated for all the damage the animals do. But if they just break down the fence, which means they didn't succeed to do what they wanted to do, and the animals get out on their own, they're not obligated for the damage done by the animals. That's what the Mishnah says. But the case of your neighbor breaking the fence is different. Why is it different? Says the Rambam. It's the first word of the fifth line. didn't get the name of it, I'm sorry. Aval im hi nichu hu asham, hare lo asu hanesek shenit kavnu lo, shua gneiva. But if they left the animals there, they left them there, didn't take them, hare lo asu hanesek shenit kavnu lo, behold, they didn't do the damage they meant to do. Shua gneiva, which is the ceiling. Lefichach pituim. Therefore, they're exempt from the damage the animals do.
So it's an interrupted robbery.
It's an interrupted robbery.
Or a botched robbery.
A botched robbery. Aval, last four words of the line, aval paritz gader lefnei beimat chavero, but someone who breaks down the fence in the face of the animal of his fellow, ein kavanato lignov, his intention is not to steal. Velonit kaven elishet teitzea beimavet teizik. His intention is not except that the animal go forth and cause damage. And that the owners will be obligated in the damage. Why do I go into your backyard and break down the fence? Because I want your animal to go out, do damage, and I want you to have to pay for it. I'm doing it.
So that's a damamazik.
So it's different. It's not a damamazik, but it's different. That is, if it's a neighbor, his intention is to get you to pay for the damage the animals will do.
Well, didn't we talk about a difference between a neighbor that was like trying to cause trouble and a neighbor that was just kind of a goofball or something?
No, I don't remember ever talking about that in my life.
Say,
but why say this is Hayav Bedine Adam and not Bedine?
No, we're talking Bedine Adam.
What I mean to say is like this. Fine, so his intention was such and such that you should be Hayav. But why should we say there are conditions we said before where you don't have to pay Bedini Adam but Bedini Shemaim you really should.
Right.
Why shouldn't that just be here where
I understand the question. Very good question. Jeremy is saying that this is an interesting difference between the fellow and the rabbis, but why should that make a halachic difference? The laws are as they are. And the law is, if the person who broke down the fence didn't acquire the animal acquisition, then how can he be chayav? I understand. Okay. I'll answer that in a second.
Okay.
Rambam doesn't answer it, but I think there's an answer.
Okay.
I just want to read the answer of the Rambam. So the Rambam goes on to say, in the last two words of the line, ulefichach hu chayav boto nezik. Therefore, the guy, the neighbor, is obligated in that nezik, the nezik that he wanted the balabai to be obligated in. Therefore, the neighbors in obligate in that both to an ezek kedin kol mazik, as is the law of every mazik, of every damager.
So he talks about nezik.
So it can't be that the Rambam is saying that this guy is like a dama mazik.
Why?
Because he's not. Dama mazik is when you directly did it.
Oh,
but the Rambam says it's like every mazik. It's like every person who does damage. Because you intended to cause the balabai damage, therefore you have to pay. But Jeremy's question is good, but I understand the moral logic, but what's the legal logic? So I was thinking to myself that the Rambam must be saying that this is a kanas, this is a fine that the rabbis levied because they realized that otherwise the law would simply be unjust. How could you have a law that a neighbor comes in, wants to cause you damage by letting your animals out, and he does that, and he's not obligated, the world would just be hefker.
Right.
So I think the Rambam is saying that this is a special case, and the rabbis enacted a special enactment. It's not deraita, I'm assuming, it's a derabanan. The deraita really should be patur, because the neighbor doesn't own the animals. But he's classified as if he was a direct mazik, even though he's not. Because of his attention, so the rabbis put upon him a certain extra special law. I think that's what the Rambam must mean. So the Rambam made this up, right? The Gemara doesn't say it. I guess because he felt a need for it. He felt that it just couldn't be otherwise. Just
he might have had bad neighbors.
So we have no time, but I wanted to end with something else, so I'll use the time anyway, right? We can take 5 or 10 more minutes?
Yeah,
sure.
And it has nothing to do with the subject, but it's just suggested by the last line of the Rambam. Look what the Rambam says at the very end.
An Oe Echad.
Yes, we're going to...
I was curious about that.
So let's read from here. The Rambam ends with a flourish.
Yes.
And the flourish is, it's five words from the end of the last full line. V'harei kol advarim nechonim. And behold, it's all true. The Rambam is saying, wow, I managed to reconcile all the sources. And he did, right? V'yotzim al ikarei adinim. And they come forth on the principle of the law. V'kulam nitnu miro'echat. And they're all given by one shepherd. Beautiful. It's a literary flourish. Look, everything worked out well. However, those words at the very end, all were given by one shepherd. He's quoting a source in the Gemara, which I happen to know.
Okay.
And I realized that the Rambam is implying a very different interpretation of those words than you would normally think. Let's think for a second. When the Rambam says all of them were given by one shepherd, the one shepherd is God, what is he saying? He's saying that if it is your neighbor who broke down the fence and the animals did damage, the neighbor is Hayav. If it's Listim, the Listim are Patur. Even though you would think these two laws contradict each other, they don't. I explain to you, it's a difference of intention. Right? So they're all given by one shepherd. For the Rambam, that means they're all true at the same time. But under different cases. The Chayav is when it's a neighbor. The Patur is when it's a Listim. Right? So in other words, there's no contradiction. It's just different cases.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Rambam's saying. But the Rambam takes that phrase from a Talmudic passage, which it's not talking about different laws for different cases. Rather, he's taken from a Gemara that says there are different laws for the same cases because there's lots of different opinions. You know what I'm saying? Let's read the Gemara that the Rambam's taking from, and I go to you in English just so it'll go faster. It could take us a good 15 minutes to understand the whole Talmudic passage. I think Jeremy learned this with me before. So let's look in English. He also took up the text and expounded. It's talking about Reb Lazar ben Azariah. The words of the wise are his goads, and his nails well planted are the words of masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. Why? And that's a verse from Ecclesiastes. Or is it from... Yeah, Ecclesiastes. Why are the words of the Torah likened like goads that you use to push the ox when he's plowing? To teach you that just as a goad directs the heifer along its furrow in order to bring forth life to the world, so the words of the Torah direct those who study them from the paths of death to the paths of life. The Torah is like a goat, it brings forth life to the world. But should you think that just as a goat is movable, so the words of the Torah are movable, right? The goat, you can bring anything, do anything with it. Is that the same as Torah, can do anything with it? No. Therefore, the text says, as nails. Looks like I wrote French here, and how do I do that? I don't know. As nails. Now, the Torah is both like goads and like nails. It's a compromise between nails and goads. But should you think that just as a nail diminishes and does not increase, in those days nails were made of metal that rusted and disappeared.
Oh, okay.
So nails diminished and didn't decrease. So to the words of the Torah, diminish and do not increase. Do you think the Torah is like a nail in that sense? It decreases over time? No. Therefore, the Torah says well planted. It's like nails, but it's also like plants that grow. It's not like nails that disappear. Just as the plant grows and then increases, so the words of Torah grow and increase. The masters of assemblies, right? The verse also talked about masters of assemblies. These are the disciples of the wise who sit in manifold assemblies and occupy themselves with the Torah, some pronouncing unclean and others pronouncing clean. Some pronouncing, I built that a word, some pronouncing forbidden, others permitting, some disqualified, and others declaring fit. So the rabbis all contradict themselves. Should a man say, how in these circumstances should I learn Torah? Right? I can't learn Torah. The rabbis all give me different answers. They're all saying, this is allowed, this is forbidden, this is yes, this is no, this is black, this is white. I can't trust any rabbi. Right? Very difficult. Therefore, the text says, all of them are given from one shepherd. Understand, even though there are different opinions, they all are part of God's Torah. One shepherd. With a capital S. One God gave them, one leader uttered them from the mouth of the Lord of all creation, blessed be, for it is written, and God spoke all these words. All the contradictory words, God spoke them. It's all part of God's Torah. Also do thou make thine ear like a hopper. A hopper is like a funnel. Make your ear into a hopper, and get thee a I'm terrible, I wrote this very fast. Get thee a perceptive heart. to understand the words of those who pronounce unclean and the words of those who pronounce clean, the words of those who prohibit and the words of those who permit, the words of those who disqualify and the words of those who declare fit. That's it. In other words, it's saying that you should be able to accept multiple truths. They're all from one God, even though they're different. And that's the meaning of the verse, that they're all given by one shepherd. So in the Talmudic passage, they're all given by one shepherd, means multiple opinions that contradict each other should understand they came from one shepherd. The Rambam uses the phrase differently. The Rambam says all from one shepherd means we can figure out how they're all true in different cases. Not that they're contradictory truths, we have to accept contradictory truths as the Gemara says, but rather we have to accept that they're all true in different cases. But there's no contradictory truth. This is when the guy meant to steal your sheep. This is when he meant to break down your fence so you'd be obligated. So we actually have discovered here, and I find this fascinating, an indication, kind of derech agav, by the way, of the Rambam's epistemology. And this can be found in 20, 30 other cases. The Rambam didn't accept what I consider to be the Talmudic approach to multiple truths. The Rambam was an Aristotelian. There's only one truth. And he finds a way to reinterpret this Talmudic passage against its whole context, but that doesn't matter. That's fascinating.
That's amazing. So he doesn't follow your teacher?
Oh, no, not at all.
So your teacher must have disliked the Rambam?
Oh, no, not at all.
No, because it's one of the many truths.
Yeah.
In general, the Chochmei Sfarad, the Sephardi authorities, took an approach of one truth. The Ashkenazi authorities, following Tosfot, took the approach that there are lots of different possibilities.
This is why they were more comfortable with the Midrashim.
It could be. I don't know. Okay.
Homeward bound.
Okay.
Have a good trip home. Oh, it's only 30 seconds.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Hi.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was very, very good.
You are welcome.
And you know, like last